Chamishi. Here again is we have kind of sometimes sort of a magic synergy. So it's interesting here. I don't know if anyone ever would have conducted a study like this about how you find parallels sometimes from one week to the next in the same place. So last week we were talking about Chamishi of Toldos. This week we're talking about Chamishi of Vayetze. And both of them are areas in which there's a discussion about the honesty of Yaakov. And of course, we maintain that Yaakov represents honesty. Now we say Titan Emes Yaakov, that was his dominant quality. And yet, we have these challenging sections in the Parashios. So last week we talked about the masquerading as Esav, that was in Chamishi, and now this week there is a slightly more complex episode involving Lavan and involving Yaakov's salary. And whether or not there is anything deceptive here is a matter of debate. There are those, many, who ask the question that Yaakov's behavior here seems to be a little bit sketchy. And we'll see, there are many interpretations in the Rishonim already, and in the later Sfarim as well, that give the story a little bit more context. So, to parallel last week's discussion, so we have this week's discussion, let's take a little bit of a look at Chamishi of Vayetze. So, here, we have this discussion between Lavan and Yaakov, about Yaakov's working on behalf of Lavan. So Lavan has said at the end of the previous Aliyah, so Yaakov, if you do good work for me, I want you to stay. So he begins this Aliyah and says, Vayomar, nakva scharcha alai ve'etena. You should tell me what your wage is, and that'll be it. I'll give that. So his response is, Vayomar elav, ata yodata, eis asher, so you know that I've done a good job for you, and you know that your flock, that your animals, have done well by me. Because before I came, you only had a little bit, and now you see, you've profited tremendously, you have a lot. And Kadosh Baruch Hu has blessed me, or blessed you rather, since I came. So now I have to also take care of my household. You know, this is evocative of a modern request for a raise. You come into your boss and you say, listen, you see how I've done well for you, you see how profits are up this quarter, and I'm happy for you, but I have to support my family, so I'm sure you understand. So what are we going to do? So he says, "Vayomer ma'atem la." Says, "What should I give you?" Vayomer Yaakov, "Lo tifein li mu'uma." You don't have to give me anything. Im tasli adover hazeh ashuva eretz soncha eshmor. So let's set up something like this that will work, and I will continue to work for you. So what are they going to do? So here again, it's complex, both just in terms of understanding it, and also in terms of even the Pashup Shat and the Psukim. So we'll just try to read the words first, and then we'll discuss a little bit of some of what has been written in terms of understanding both the morality and the details of what has happened here. So basically, the Psukim continue as follows. Evor b'chol tzoncha hayom, haser misham kol sed nakod v'talu, b'chol sechum, so I will go through your flock, and I'm going to take out all the cattle that is speckled or spotted, and all the brown cattle from among the sheep, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and that will be my hire, that will be my wage. So here, it's also not exactly clear what he means when he says, I'm going to take out. So Rashi's understanding is that he's setting up the stage to say, I'm going to take what's going to be born after this. So in order that there shouldn't be any confusion, I want it to be very clear what is my salary and what isn't. So I'm going to ask for the animals that are marked in this fashion that was just described, the ones that are born from here on in. And therefore, you shouldn't have any tain on me that I'm actually taking ones that are born already, so I'll remove them from here. So there shouldn't be any confusion. Any young animals that look like that should be taken out. That's how Rashi understands over here. V'hayaschari, Rashi writes, Osan shivaldu mekanal haba, nekudu mekfluim bo'izim, v'shachumim b'aksavim yushali, v'osan shiyeshan achshav hafresh mehem v'hafkidem bi'abanecha. So don't have any tainas on me that I'm going to play any games here. Anyone that look like that, that already exist, take those away and give them to your sons to watch. Shol somerli al hanolod me'ata. That you shouldn't think that I'm taking the ones that are already born. So elu ha'yusham t'chilo, v'yod shol otomerli al yideh ha'zcharim shen yukudim t'fluim t'iladna ha'nekevus t'gmasim mekan v'ela. So I don't want you to have any time on me that I'm using these animals in order to create more of them, or that I'm taking any one of the young animals. Take them all away. So that's Rashi's interpretation. We'll see that there are other ways of reading what's going on here. It's not 100% clear how the Pesukim are meant to be interpreted, but that's how Rashi understands what's going on. So then he goes on to say, V'ansa b'tzikasi b'yom machar. So my tzikas, my righteousness, will speak on my behalf tomorrow. Ki savo al schari b'fanecha, kol asher nenu nakod v'talu b'izim, v'chum b'ksavim ganuhu iti. So you'll see my righteousness will speak on my behalf. When you look to see what I have, you'll see that all I have is the marked animals, the speckled and the spotted, and the brown ones, and that anything that's not that, if I have that, then it's considered a geneva, it's considered your property. So Yomar Laban, Hein Lu Yichid Varecha. So Laban said, okay, sounds like we could do it that way. Some of the Mefarshim point out that the Pesukim sounds like he's going back and forth. Hey, Lu Yechid Varecha, that maybe he's equivocating here. This is reflective of the fact that he's going to equivocate a lot. But in any event, he ultimately agrees. V'yaser b'yom ha'hu es ha'tiyashim ha'akudim v'ha'tzluim v'yeis kol ha'izim ha'nekudos v'ha'tzluos kol asher lovan bo. So Lavan took out all of the male goats that had the stripes or the spots, and all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, and every animal that had any whitening at all, and all the brown sheep, and he gave them to his sons. And again, now here, his sons, this is Rashi's interpretation, that he gave it to his own sons, that this is what he was fulfilling here, Yaakov's arrangement based on how Rashi understands it, that they should be removed from the whole set here and given to Lavan's sons to watch. And again, there are other ways of reading that pasuk, and we'll come back to that as well. So, the next pasuk continues. V'yasam derech shloshes yamin b'no v'ben Yaakov v'Yaakov roes son Lavan hanusaros. So then there was a 3-day distance that was placed between them. Again, it was subject to debate exactly whose initiative that was or what was the purpose of this distance, but there was a distance placed between them. Vayikach lo Yaakov makal livneh, lach veluz v'armon, vayifatzel behem salos levanos, machsof alavon asher ha'machos. So Yaakov took rods made out of green poplar and almond and plane tree, and he peeled white streaks in them. So exposed the white within the rods, made the white appear within the rods. V'yatzeg es hamaklos asher pitzel barahatim v'shikasos hamayim asher tavona hatzol lishtos l'nochach hatzon v'yechavna b'vol lishtos. So he put these peeled rods in front of the flocks, in the gutters, in the watering troughs. So when the flocks came to drink, that they would conceive when they came to drink, seeing these images. V'yechemu hatzon es hamaklos, v'teladna hatzon akudim nekudim utluim. So the flocks conceived in front of the rods, and they gave birth to cattle that was indeed striped, speckled, and spotted. V'aksavim hifri Yaakov, v'yitein p'nei hatzon el akom kolchum b'tzol lavan, v'yoshef slo adarim levado v'lo shosem al tzol lavan. So Yaakov separated the lambs, and he put the faces of the flocks towards the stripe, and all the ground of the flock of Laban, and he put his own flocks by themselves, not among Laban's cattle. Bahaya, b'chol yachem hatzon hamakush aros, b'tzav Yaakov es hamaklos le'ene hatzon barahatim, liachemena b'maklos. And so it came to pass that when the stronger cattle conceived children, that Yaakov put the rods before their eyes so that they would conceive in that context. Ubahatif hatzon liyasim bahaya hatufim lelavan bahakshurim liyakov. So the cattle were weak, he didn't put it in, so then it ended up that the weaker ones were Laban's and the stronger ones were Yaakov's. Vayifrod sa'ish ma'od ma'od, vayhilo tzon rabos, u'shvachos v'avadim l'gmolim v'chamorim. So he became very, very wealthy, and he had many cattle, and he had maidservants, and he had avadim, and he had camels, and he had chamorim. So what exactly happened here? And so this is a topic of much discussion, because it seems, at least an initial review, that this was basically some kind of a scam. That the deal was that whatever animals would naturally be born in this form would be Yaakov's, and the assumption would seem to be that there'd be some kind of a statistical breakdown that you could predict. And here it seems like Yaakov manipulated it and made it be that a much greater proportion of the animals would be born in the style that he was entitled to. So this is something the Farshim have a hard time with. So is this honest? Is this trickery? Is this some type of gazelle? So some of the Farshim understand that this was a reaction to Laban. So, for example, this is what the Arachayim writes, and the Shamshon Fal Hirsch, and the Yosnayim LaTorah, that the plan was that Laban was only supposed to take out the younger animals that could have been confused for the animals that Yaakov was supposed to get that were going to be born next. But Laban went beyond that and took away all of the marked animals, all the spotted and speckled and brown animals, leaving it to be the case that al pi derech hateva, you couldn't expect there to be any animals that Yaakov could have got. So basically, this was a scam that Laban was perpetrating on Yaakov, that he reduced the odds in the other direction, he manipulated the odds in the other direction, so that instead of a statistical distribution that could have been predictable, now there'd be nothing for Yaakov. And presumably the whole plan, by the way, that Yaakov, if you want to consider the plan the abstract, it would seem like Yaakov was looking for some type of system which could be very definable. That if you have these animals that have these very blatant markings, so then it wouldn't be subject to dispute. You could say this one's clearly his and that one's clearly Laban's. So it was designed to be a system that wouldn't lend itself to too much confusion. But here you have Laban now pulling a fast one on him and manipulating the odds so that there aren't going to be any children of the animals that are going to be Jacobian. So Yaakov, just to finish the point, so Yaakov then had to offset that with these rods. That was a replacement for the actual animals that could have had that comparable effect. So if that's the case, it's understandable he's merely trying to recalibrate things that the way they could have been. And this is a very weak substitute, as these Mefarshim all point out when they make this comment, that clearly it would have been much better odds had there been actual living animals there of this nature to either inspire or to create such a pattern. So the rods are a weak substitute for that, and the truth is, one would think the whole thing is really unique, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is protecting him and creating this miraculous intervention to allow him to get something, and allow him to get a lot, and really he didn't even have to do the rods either. And the only reason he did that, as the Hirsch suggests, is because of Ein Tzom Kol Ha'anes. He didn't want to rely totally on that, so he did the best he could in order to try to make up for how Laban had skewed things. Are you, had a question?
So what was his attempt to return it back to the same odds they were before, or to counterbalance Laban, bringing it in the negative direction to the extreme positive?
I don't know if there's a real difference between those two.
Meaning, was he trying to scam in the other, the response to a scammer is to scam him or to make it fair.
Right. So I think you could say really just to make it fair. I want to discuss that point in a second. So I mentioned one more interpretation. Maybe we'll come back to that point because I think your question is an important one in terms of that particular focus. But the narrow issue of was he just replacing the same tool to the extent he could or trying to average it out by swinging in the other direction, that I'm not sure if there's a massive difference. But the last point, we'll come back to in a minute. So the Das Kanan had a similar approach, a little bit different. And he understood that Das Kanan Bali Atosus, right, that he had to deal with Lavan was that Lavan would leave the Tluim, so at least there'd be a little bit of a chance that there would be a mixed progeny, and Lavan reneged on that. So again, both of those interpretations, two different spins on the same thing, that essentially Lavan messed things up so that the normal statistical possibilities were not going to happen. So this was Yaakov trying to restore some order. So in terms of Arya's question, so I think it's a fair question. Is there basically a statement here that you can scam a scammer? Is that the idea? Or is this something else? You know, is this basically just restoring the natural order and doesn't have anything even slightly scammy about it? So here, I think there's a case one could make that he's basically just putting things back into their natural way. He's just, especially if you combine this with a few other interpretations that we'll see in a moment, that he's basically just putting things back to normal. But there are those who associate this with the Pasuk in Tehillim, which still, I think, leaves it open to some question. The Pasuk says, "In Navar tisbarar, v'yemikesh tispatal." So what does that Pasuk mean? So the Pasuk, let's say, translated, I think also it leaves itself open for a couple of different interpretations, but it basically sounds like it means you should be honest with honest people. If a person is barar, a person is pure, so then you should be pure with them. V'yemikesh tispatal, but if a person is perverse, translated that way, so then what should you be? You should be subtle. That's how it's translated. So I want to be careful in how to apply that because I think it could be read a couple different ways. If you want to be kind of crude about it, you could say that it means that if somebody scams you, you scam them. That's a legitimate approach to somebody who's scamming you. I think it could be read in a little more of a subtle way, to use the word that was just used in the translation of that term, that ideally we will be very open and pashut and trusting with people. People will deal with people who are pashut and straightforward, and we'll be able to be very pashut and straightforward. But you should not let yourself get scammed. You should not let yourself be a ashmata and be a tool of somebody else's dishonesty. So if you're dealing with somebody who is himself dishonest, so then you have to be clever, which might be different. Not that you should deceive him, that you treat him the way he treats you, but that you have to be more complex. You have to be more aware of what's going on. So, for example, in this case, one could say that this tool that Yaakov was using here was not, by its nature, illegitimate. It's not the most straight-up way of doing things. So if the odds were fair and normal, so then he wouldn't have utilized this because he'd want to be 100% straightforward in every way. But since it's technically within their agreement, it was the tool that was open to him. And because Lavan's not being so straight up, so then he has to be aware that he's being taken advantage of and take an approach that's a little bit less straightforward. But not that it's deceptive and it's straight out nature. You know, this is a question that really also hinges on what exactly was their understanding. And that's something we'll see is also a subject of discussion. The Ramban over here writes that the deal was between the two of them that Yaakov could do whatever he wants to, whatever he needs to, in order to manipulate the odds. That was the open deal between the two of them, that they basically said, okay, we have this agreement that I get the marked animals, and whatever I want to do that I think may affect that, I'm allowed to do. And Lavan knew about that. But then the Ramban complicates things by also suggesting that Lavan didn't have any idea of the science, if you want to call it that, the technology that's being used here. He didn't know that existed. He didn't know this was a method. So that opens up the question. So just again, is this the kind of deal you'd want to make with an honest person? Would you want to make a deal that says, okay, here's how we're going to divide things, and I also have the right to do whatever I want to increase my portion, and there's a method they don't even know about that I end up using. So is that totally honest, totally straight up? Presumably, if you're dealing with a person who's totally honest with you, that's not really the way to do things. But it's technically within their agreement. So if the person who you're dealing with is himself dishonest, so maybe that's an appropriate type of response. So this all goes to the question, how do you relate to this whole idea of in the cage? Does it mean that you should skin him? Which the Gemara does kind of read it that way, the Gemara in Megillah and elsewhere, the Gemara in Megillah and Daf Yud Gimel says, is it permissible for a tzaddik to act for a most, to act with trickery? So it depends if he's dealing with somebody who tricks him. And the Gemara quotes this pasuk, and just for synergy purposes, we'll mention that in the Sefer Sanhedrin Ketana, to the Sefer Sanhedrin, in the Hafdama, he talks about Emes and Emes Liyakov, but he mentions this idea in this context that that's also a part of Emes. So one could also maybe say that comes up in the context of Kabbalah Lashon Hara, that Sefer Achinuch understands that part of the idea of not being makabo false Lashon Hara, slanderous statements, so Sefer Achinuch understands that Midvar Sheker Tirchak means not only that you should not lie, but the language of Tirchak, stay far away from it, you should not even be lied to. You should be a educated consumer, you should be careful not to be misled. And that's also a part of distancing from Sheker. So to here, you shouldn't be so pushy that you just let people scam you and it's no problem. So maybe that's also part of honesty, is that you don't allow dishonesty to take root even when you are the victim. You don't just say, okay, I'm a shmata, do whatever you want as long as I'm honest, but you also don't let other people be dishonest with you. I think Jacob was up before.
You kind of answered it, but like, you're not allowed, like in Judaism, you're not allowed to lie, really. Or you so. I understand you're not, if someone's deceiving you, that you brought the Gemara, does that really make it okay?
So that's the question. Certainly without that, it wouldn't be okay. Right? There's no question that in a normal business arrangement, this would not be okay. But we do know in some contexts, we do find heterim for sheker in certain settings. So we have to know, is this the kind of setting that would allow it? So it seems to be that this is some kind of, at its worst, this is some kind of a self-defense strategy, which says, basically, in the Paris Yosef, it happens to be somebody just wrote to me this week asking me, I think what was for him, Halacha Maisa, Shaila about this, that, you know, is there a concept of rodef in non-lethal areas? You know, that we say that when somebody comes to kill you, so the Gemara says, Haba lahargecha hashkeim lahargo, that if somebody is coming to kill you, you kill him first. So this person was asking, you know, not necessarily he's killing you, but other things. So is there an idea that you chop him before he chops you? So if you look, for example, in the Parshas Yosef, in the Sixth Parsha, so he has, in this context, such a discussion based on this idea, this Pasuk in Tehillim, in this Gemara, that if, and he explicitly says that this is a version of the idea of Rodef, that we say that somebody comes to kill you, so you kill him first. So maybe there is such an idea. You're not obligated to be anybody else's victim, and you can do what's necessary in order to protect yourself. But again, it could be that it should be said a little bit more subtly than this, and that it doesn't even mean that you're scamming the other person. As much as you're working within the structures that exist, it may be a way that you wouldn't if you weren't pushed against the wall, but keep yourself from being victimized. Maybe that's not even called lying. So in this case, many Mefarshim ask about the story. Clearly, this is a story that troubles many people. The question is, you know, is he even doing anything dishonest at all? So within the Ramban's interpretation, let's say, if this was a term of their deal, so then maybe this is straight out. You know, this is necessarily called gezel. So again, it's not the kind of thing that strikes us as 100% perfect, but it's the kind of thing that was necessary within the letter of their agreement in order to protect his own portion as far as would be otherwise legitimate. So it's also a whole discussion, as far as Jacob's question specifically, the question of the Isser Sheker. So there are some who understand that, many who understand that the Isser Sheker is a ben adam l'chavero, that the person is going to be hurt by your deception specifically. That's where you have the Isser of Sheker in the absolute sense. So if the consequence of the Sheker is that things are going to be restored the way they're meant to be, so one could argue that doesn't really even enter into the Isser of Sheker in the first place. Possibly. Again,
he agreed to a deal.
Sorry?
You say you think his love on Qin, one of the reasons you said was his love on made it almost impossible for Yako, but
right.
Just because someone agrees to a deal that's ridiculous doesn't make the deal less binding.
No, that's not the case. That's not what happened at all. The deal in the face was not ridiculous. The thing is, afterwards, Lovun pulled shtick that undid it. So, Lovun pulled shtick, so he pulled stick. He put the stick there to offset the shtick. So, that might be, they're both working women, or at least Yaakov was working women later. He's not saying that I regret having agreed to the deal. He's saying that the deal could have been good, and within the letter of the law of the deal, this is what I'm doing in order to protect myself. So again, I think there's a lot to try to figure out here in terms of whether this is even considered trickery in the other direction or not. I have to be, we have to try to very carefully thread the needle between understanding exactly what the message is and making sure not to be motzilaz on the others. So we want to be careful not to overstate. The story isn't 100% clear, that's what was going on, so we need to try to understand it as honestly as possible, while also being aware of the possibility that maybe it's not how it could otherwise be interpreted, and therefore I'm trying to be very cautious in the way we're understanding the story. Hi.
When we said that the Sefer Chinuch says that you can't allow yourself to be misled, we're relating that to allowing oneself to be taken advantage of.
Yeah, I think it could be a related concept. That just Midvar Sheker Teruchak is such a broad concept. Not only should you not be the liar, but you shouldn't participate in the lie. You shouldn't be the recipient of the lie. So that would mean you shouldn't be misled, and especially even the more consequential kind of lie, that means being swindled. You shouldn't allow yourself to be swindled. There's no mila to be such a pashut person that, oh, just everyone can walk all over me and victimize me, and that's how honest I am. That's not a part of honesty. A part of honesty is you treat people honestly, and you also make sure that people don't take advantage of you, too. So you try to do that in as straightforward a fashion as possible. Which are the big yesod, which is why, again, we have to be very careful how to extrapolate from this, because we spoke about this a little bit, and here's for some synergy points, we spoke about this a little bit when talking about Gezel and Geneva, and the differences between the two. So if you recall, we said that gezel means to deprive somebody else of their money, and that geneva is gezel plus. And geneva is depriving them of their money while also doing it in a sneaky fashion. And that sneakiness is its own avera, is its own corruption. And that even if you had scenarios where you could subtract the gezel, where you're not actually depriving somebody of their justly acquired money, and you're simply acting like a sneaky thief, that itself seems to have its own prohibition. So we discussed the Gemara that we're not allowed to steal even if he's going to return it, even if he's just stealing as a practical joke. And there's a statement in the Gemara as well that, let's say somebody else has your property, somebody is has something that is very clearly and definably and unquestionably yours, so you're allowed to take it back, but the Gemara has a statement that you should go into the front door, you shouldn't go through the back door, you shouldn't break in like a ganav and take it, even though all you're doing is taking your own property, but to act like a ganav is corruptive of your character, and you should just come into the front door and say, I'm taking mine, and not act in any way similar to a ganav. So that perhaps suggests that even when you're acting to protect yourself, you try to be as careful as possible not to allow this deceptive nature to infect you, and we discussed this a little bit last week, right, that one of the interpretation that the Rosh Yeshiva Karen Biavna discussed about what we saw in last week's Chamishi, that the whole idea of Anochi Esav Becharecha, and Rashi commenting there that Anochi Hamevi Lecha Esav Becharecha, and how that seems like a very weak way to try to save yourself from Sheker. So the point was, no, it's going to be deceptive. That's what had to be. That was the Harah of the Shah. But Yaakov tried to make sure that he didn't lose his character as an honest person by working to protect whatever connection to MS he had. So here it's a little bit different, because here there's a possibility that it's not deceptive at all. In Masbuk's parasha, it's very hard to read that into the story that there isn't some degree of deception. Here it's a little bit more open to other interpretations. So again, I'm trying to be very cautious in how to say this, that there are many, many svarim that are very troubled by this and try to understand how it could be appropriate. There are svarim that suggest that this is reflective of a heter or a need to act a little bit craftily with somebody who's acting craftily with you, and there are Beforshim who see it in a totally different way, that there's no dishonesty here at all. So I think to study this Aliyah, we have to be open to all those possibilities, while also be careful not to overstate in a way that is motzilaz on Yavos. Yeah, yes, Aryeh. Okay, so there are a few other interpretations. The Ramban that we mentioned before, so the Ramban also brings another interpretation, the Yesh Omrim, that totally redefines the story. It says that first you had the first generation of children that were born, and then Yaakov was just afraid that the children that were born from that generation, they would be his because they were the children of his own animals. But if they were not marked, so then Lavan would claim that they were Lavan's animals. So in order to hold on to the animals that he already had and to protect himself, so that was the purpose. And that clearly recasts the whole story. Hi.
Didn't Yaakov feel that, I think Rashi's interpretation was, we mentioned that they would separate the field and the Atis of Lavan couldn't claim that?
Yeah, so the question is talking about the next generation. What Rashi was talking about is there were animals that were already there, right? And the deal was, according to Rashi, we're about to mention a different interpretation, according to Rashi, the deal was, I'm not taking any animal that already has been born. I'm only taking future animals. But the concern was that if there were young animals that were mixed in that could be confused with newborns, so then Laban will say, oh, the newborns are early existing animals. So they took out all the existing animals that were marked this way so that there wouldn't be any confusion. That was what Rashi was saying. Now we're saying something else. It's saying, the Ramban is saying that maybe now animals were born that were legitimately Yaakov's, but Yaakov was concerned that those animals would give birth to animals that were not marked that way. They would be legally Yaakov's because the children of his own animals, but he was afraid that Lavan would claim that they're his, so he made sure that the already existing animals that belonged to him, or the animals already he was entitled to, because the children of his own animals, they would also be born in a way that would be indisputably his. So there's another interpretation also, which differs from Rashi, that's what I kept preparing you for in the past few minutes, a different way to read it, that the Or Zeruah, in the Shuvas Or Zeruah HaGadol, in Siman Tavshin Samach Tes, it's worth looking up because in Hebrew it rhymes. The whole poetic presentation of the same story. It's quoted in numerous forms. For example, what's easiest for you to find probably is the Paris Yosef. It's available in the Beis Medrash. Paris Yosef, we've mentioned several times, right? Paris Yosef is Rav Yosef Patsanovsky, so it's a fancier edition that was published more recently. So you can look it up there. He has a pretty lengthy discussion of all different interpretations. And he quotes this, or Zeru also, Master Gestetner quotes it in the Sefer HaChumash. You can find it in a few places if you can't find the Zeru so easily. But it's worth reading in Hebrew to see the whole poetry. So he has a different understanding than Rashi. So he understands that, yes, Yaakov was trying to set up a scenario here where Lavan would not be able to cheat him at all. So he made a deal regarding these animals that were easily identifiable. And here's again a difference from Rashi. The deal included the animals that were already born. Not like Rashi says, only the animals that will be born later. It included all the animals that were there already. That was part of the deal. So when he says, take out all those animals, he didn't mean take them away so they shouldn't confuse things. Like Rashi says, he means take them for me. And when he says, give them to the sons, it doesn't mean, like Rashi says, give them to Lavan's sons to protect them in a separate place. It means give them to my sons, give them to Reuben and Shimon to hold on to because they're going to be ours. So then he only put these sticks by his own animals so that they would be his descendants from those animals, but they were already separated from Lavan's animals. And that was the whole nature of what was going on. So again, it's a completely different reading of the story.
Why did he put sticks by his own animals?
Because he wanted his own animals to continue having progeny that would look like that, so it would be unarguable. The whole point was he only wanted animals that were very self-evidently his. That was the whole reason of picking something like this. So that's how he had hoped to ensure that.
So, I mean, after he does the stick, and the shtick, so it says that he separated the animals and the animals that were Lavan's.
Mm-hmm.
only after that. So meaning we're saying that that pasuk, Ksavim Hifrid Yaakov, that pasuk is referring to afterwards when he mixed them all together, then he separated the ones that were.
You have to say something like that, I think. Yeah, I don't think it explicitly addresses it in his explanation. I think you have to say something like that. Similarly, the Truma Sadashin, in his Birim HaNchumish, Birim HaRai, so he said that the original deal with Yaakov and Lavan was that these three different physical characteristics that have been mentioned, the deal was that any one of those three, if it had any one of those three simanim, it would be Yaakov's. But Yaakov was afraid that Lavan would say something else. He would say that it has to have all three in order to be his. So therefore, in order to account for that, he put up this image, a stick, that had two of these simanim. So therefore, he couldn't be accused by Lavan of using that for anything illegitimate, because Lavan would have to agree that only one simon would be enough in order to make such a claim. So if Lavan was going to assert the position that it has to be all three, then Moshitaso, this smakel is not going to cause a problem, and it's going to perhaps address then this suffix that Lavan could have put into the story. Okay, so again, many different interpretations of what's going on. This is a hotly debated section of the Chumash, and parallels again the same aliyah in last week's parsha. So then the next parsha concludes within this aliyah. So the psukim continue, V'yishma is divrei v'nei Lavan le'mor. So the sons of Lavan, they hear what happened, and they say, oh, lakach Yaakov, eitz kol asher la'avinu, v'me asher li'avinu asa es kol ha'kavod hazeh. So as some of the portion point out, this is very reminiscent of later anti-Semitic expressions. Oh, you see, the Jews have taken all our wealth, and they have become rich on our backs, and they've taken everything, and there's no acknowledgement of the contributions that they made to that wealth in the first place, or the fact that they built it up. This is just an accusation that they took everything. The Kli Yakar has a comment here that the statement of Lakach Yaakov Eis Kol Asher La'avinu, he took everything that comes from our father. He's referring to the cleverness also. You see that even this ability to be on top of the other one, so that was supposed to be Lavan's unique defining feature. And not only does Yaakov end up rich, but even his skill he has taken over. And some suggest that that's the same thing that Esav said in last week's parsha of the Yaakveni Zepamayim, that this double offense that he accuses Yaakov of, that not only did Yaakov get the better of me, but he got the better of me using my own skill set, and that's especially painful. So, in any event, the psukim continue after hearing this comment. So, Vayar Yaakov is pnei Lavan, v'hinei nenu imo kismol shulshom. So, Yaakov senses that the atmosphere has shifted, that Lavan's not so friendly with him anymore. His kids aren't so friendly. He's not so friendly. So he realizes that the atmosphere is changing. Vayomer Hashem el Yaakov shuv el eretz avosecha ulamalatecha ve'ehya imach. So God says to Yaakov, go back to the land of your fathers and your family, and I will be with you. Chafetz Chaim has a whole discussion over here in one of his farm. And the Yodnayim LaTorah has a comment here also that, again, this is a little bit of a symbol for the future, and this is something which, in one sense, we can very much relate to with current events, that Lavan's basically saying, here we have Lavan's son saying your anti-Semitic statements, and right after that, Hashem says, time for you to go back to your homeland. And these svarim all right, that this is a symbol for the future, that when you see the nations of the world really ramping up their persecution, so it's sometimes the finger of HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying, you know, it's time to go back home, it's time to go back to Eretz Yisrael. And we're seeing perhaps a lot of that nowadays, although of course we're also seeing tremendous HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Eretz Yisrael as well, as we saw too painfully today. So this is on some level perhaps resonant, particularly in the contemporary environment. Hi.
So, I was going to ask, when the anti-Semitism happens in Israel, what's the message then?
Yeah, I don't know. Right. So again, take this as you will, but to whatever extent it's applicable specifically in Chutz La'aretz, this is a comment that you find in some have. So in a few psukim, you're going to see that Yaakov is going to take Rachel and Leah aside and explain to them, you know, things have gotten bad here and we might as well go. So in the Sefer Som Derech, he has a long essay about this, which is Chodos Lebroi, that, you know, one could say that this is apparently a nevuah. He's given a command from God to go back to Eretz Yisrael. So why does he have to talk his wives into it? Why doesn't he just say, listen, we're religious people, God has told us we got to go back, that's the whole story. So why does he have to explain that it makes sense, and other reasons to go back? So he suggests, and say for Som Derech in general, so he has two sections. He has long essays in the back, and then he has shorter comments in the front. And very often in the shorter comments, they'll refer you to the longer essays. They'll give you a little bit of a hint of what he talks about in the long essay. So this is one of the topics that he has a long essay about, and he just explains the thesis of the essay in his comment on this pasuk in the front section. He says that, in general, there is a ideal that one should always try to minimize the nisayon. That one who's trying to fulfill his religious obligations, and especially when talking to the rest of his family, so one should try to make it as easy as possible. One should not try to emphasize, oh, you see how firm I am, that I'm able to do this even though it's a very big challenge. Oh, everything's wonderful here, everything's perfect, and yet we'll leave because God told us to leave. It's always kedai to try to make it as easy as possible to fulfill God's word. So therefore, Yaakov understood that even though he could just say, listen, that's the mitzvah, that's what we're doing, but he realized that it's valuable to try to also point out why it's consistent with other factors and why it would make sense to do that also. And in the back, there's a long essay bringing many proofs that that's a worthwhile approach to life in general. There's a parallel to the statement at the end. We'll come back to it in a moment. Keep this in mind because we'll come back to this idea in a few minutes.
Who said that?
So the Som Derech, Rav Chaim Lebroi, with Rashi and Chevron, has a long essay making this point through different examples and tying it to this pasuk, tying it to this idea.
When Avram takes Yitzchak to the Akedah, Yitzchak asks where the animals are, he says something like, we'll see it on the way. He doesn't exactly explain. Is this an application of that? Or
perhaps. I don't remember whether it's in his essay or not. There's many different examples in his essay, but it could be that, in general, we're not looking to show how heroic we are by creating the most challenging environment possible, but to whatever extent it's possible for us to make it a little bit less of an science. So we try to do that. That's the advisable path. And again, there'll be a parallel to this in a few minutes. So the next pasuk, it's interesting, is quoted in the Gemara in the first parak of Brachos. So Yaakov consults with his wives. Vayishlach Yaakov vayikra l'Rachel ulelea hasade el tzona. So he calls Rachel and Leah to the field. So the Gemara says that there is a message here. The Gemara in Chesem and Beis Masechus Brachos has a statement that the Madoyim are beloved for one technique that they have, one practice that they have, that when they discuss personal matters, so they only do so outside in the field. And why do they do that? So Rashi explains they don't want to be overheard. It's a certain protection for one's privacy. And the walls have ears. And that's not a modern expression. That's a direct quotation from Rashi. Rashi over there, Bracha, says, literally, Oznayim Lakoso. So if you ever wondered how old that expression is, it's at least 1,000 years old. As Rashi has it over there in the Gemara, that the walls have ears, so better not to have walls. Better to be in a wide open space where nobody can overhear you. And that's apparently a Midas Derech Eretz and good advice, that one should protect his own privacy and not allow himself to be easily overheard. The Torah Tumim and others note that maybe there's not such a good proof here, because we know, and we'll discuss this very soon, that Yaakov was very careful not to waste any time from work. So if he was working in the field, so he's not going to say, let's go into the public and talk about this somewhere else. It makes sense. He's going to talk about it there. So he suggests that maybe he could have talked about it later. He happened to talk about it there also during the workday, because that was also the appropriate place to have such a conversation. Hi.
He was still working, even though he had this bad relationship with Lavan.
At that point, yeah, that's what it seems like. So Vayomer Lahen, Roa Anochi Es Pnei Avichen Ki Einenu Alai Kismol Shulshon V'Lohei Avi Hayayi Madi. So he says to his wives, I've seen your mutual father. It's convenient, he has both wives and the same father. It makes the conversation a little more efficient. And he says that, your father, I see that things are not So you see that things are not so good with him, that our relationship is not what it once was. So you should be aware of that. But God has been with me. Va'atena yudaten, ki v'chol kochi avadati es avichem. And you know that I have served your father with all my power, v'chol kochi. So this statement is important because, as the Rambam understands in Hilchos Schiras, in Perek Gimel Halacha Zayin, very important statement, the Rambam understands that this has halachic ramifications, that this is teaching us the principle of a poel, that a worker is obligated to do this, and obligated to work b'chol kochi, is obligated to work with all of his strength. And he goes on to say that that's why when here you have Yaakov saying that he's received bracha from a Kadosh Baruch Hu, so the Rambam adds, it's because of that. Because he did what he had to do as a worker, he worked with his full strength, so that's why he got rich. Now, the Psalm Derech of Zimtzkos Lebroid notes that if we're learning from Yaakov, we could also learn that we see later on when he talks to Lavan, he says that he does much more, that he really worked himself like crazy, even beyond Kol Kocho. So that maybe is not relevant because there he was only saying what they would relate to. But here he's just conveying what the actual chiyuv is. And the Sefer Mishnas Aharon is another contemporary Sefer, so he asks why the Rambam adds this part, that that's why Yaakov got the bracha. So he asks, how do we know that that's why he became rich? And how do we know that his kol kocho is the real din? Maybe that was the finisher sedin. So he explains that the statement of kol kocho, he was saying to his wives, because he was worried the wives would think that he stole something from Lavan, that he didn't really earn what he had. So therefore, he was emphasizing to them that he worked the kol kocho. And later on, when he's speaking to Lavan, he says even more than that, because to Lavan, he wants to emphasize how much Lavan was a kafui tov, how much he denied the good that Yaakov had done, so that's why it was a different emphasis. And in this context, so we just saw that Lavan's sons were saying, oh, that Yaakov really stole from him, Yaakov became rich, and he became rich off Lavan's back. So he was worried that the sisters of these sons would get that impression also. So in the context of that specific statement, that, oh, he's become rich, he's got this bracha from God, so that's where Yaakov says, I worked with all my strength, so that's how the Rambam understands that that's connected, that working with all strength is a source of bracha. So again, the Rambam brings us the halacha and the Shulchan Aruch and Simin Shin Lamed Gimel. So there are other halachas there, some of which are from other Gemaras, that a poel, it's a complicated kind of a relationship. A poel is different from a kavlan. A kavlan agrees to do a job, a specific job. So then he does the job, that's the deal. A poel is renting out his time, which is a very complex concept, which deserves a lot of study. It's a major topic in Sefer Tov Metzia. We did this in Shir 3 years ago, at some length. So that idea is different from a kavlan. He's not doing a specific task. He's basically saying, I'm yours for a certain amount of time. So that requires defining what it means to be yours. What does it mean to give yourself over to somebody for that time? So we see here that the Rambam is saying it means that whatever his maximal strength is, that's what he has to give. And therefore, not only does he have to do that during the work hours, but he can't do things during the other hours that subtract from his strength. So says in Shulchan Aruch, he shouldn't stay up all night, says he's exhausted the next day, he shouldn't fast, the Gemara says he shouldn't take on an oath of Nazirus, anything that's going to detract from his ability. And again, a little parallelism, I think, Parshas Kisese, when we were doing Chamishi a few months ago, so we saw other dinim that were in that parsha that had to do also with the idea of keeping the worker focused. And this is a source of a lot of literature. Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he asks, talking about the Rebbeim and Yeshivas that don't get paid on time, or don't get paid enough, and don't get paid on time. So is it appropriate for them to be mezalzel towards their job because they're not really getting paid? So he says, you see from Yaakov that no, that here Yaakov wasn't being treated properly by his employer, and yet he's still careful to say that he held up his part of the bargain, and it's a problem for the employer, but it's not a had to act with less than full devotion to the job itself. So there's a lot to say about this, but just to make reference to that idea, which the Rambam connects to this pasuk, Rabbi Yitzchak Kohn Shlita, who is also the human model of complete devotion with all of his energy, wrote an article about this in the Mitoch Ohel, the first volume. So that's another parallel. Last week we mentioned Rabbi Levine's article on Chamishi, and this week Rabbi Kohn wrote an article on Chamishi. So you can take a look there also for further discussion to this point. So then he tells the story, Yom Koyomar Nekudim Yes Charecha, the old Koyomar Nekudim, Yom Koyomar Akudim Yes Charecha, the old Koyomar Akudim. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu has helped me. I skipped the pasuk where he says that. Pasuk before, Pasuk Zayin, Rav Yichen, Heysel Bi, Vehechalif Es Maskorti Aseres Monim, Velo Nosnu Elohim, Lo Hara Yimadi, that your father has tried to fool me. So here again, it's stated explicitly, and he's changed my wages 10 times. And God didn't let it happen. God didn't let it hurt me. So whatever the deal was, the Kadosh Baruch Hu made sure that it would happen to his benefit. So therefore, God took what needed to be taken away from love and gave it to me. This is all the acts of the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Vayihi bo'eis yachem hatzon v'yasoinai v'ereh v'chalom v'hineh ha'atudim ha'olim ha'latzon akudim nekudim uberudim. As it came to pass at that time when the cattle conceived, it says Yaakov, I lifted up my eyes and I saw a dream, and there the rams which leaped on the cattle were striped and spotted and speckled. But Yomer Eli, Malach Elohim b'chalom Yaakov va'omar hineni. So the Malach spoke to me in a dream and called out and said, Yaakov, and said, I'm here. Vayomer sona inecho rei kol ha'atudim ha'olim ha'latzon akudim nekudim uvrudim ki ro'isi eis kol asher lavano selach. And he said, lift up your eyes and see that all they're all, I just read the pasuk, sorry. Anochi ha'el beisel asher mashachta sham atzeva asher nadarta li sham neder ata kum tzei min ha'aretz hazos v'shov al aretz mulatecha. So I am the God of Betel, where you set up this matzeva, and where you took a nether to me, so you should now get up, and you should go to that land. And thus Pasuk says, V'tan Rachel v'Leah v'tamarna lo, ha'od lanu chelet v'nachalat v'esavinu. So Rachel and Leah, they responded to them, well, Taka, things aren't so good here, we don't even have any inheritance. The whole discussion, does that mean Al-Pidin they don't have any inheritance because they were women? Or is that not the case, that the inheritance in the system of Bnei Noach would have gone to all the children, but for other reasons they thought they were disinherited, and thus they just were going to get fooled out of their inheritance too? It's not 100% clear. It's a discussion finding that is foreign, but I say basically things aren't so good here. So the Pasuk suggests, V'tan Rachel v'Leah, the Pasuk suggests that Rachel spoke first. And there is a striking statement in the Medrash that because Rachel answered before her older sister, so she died first. So that's a pretty big onish. So Rav Schwab says, really, that's such an avera for the younger sister to speak before the older sister. It's such a terrible avera that that should be the consequence. So he explains that he thinks a little bit more than that, that here, they're not just, Rachel is not just disrespecting Leah by speaking first. That, of course, was a relatively minor thing. But he's speaking really badly about her father here. The next pasuk continues. Halo nachrios nechshavnu lo kimacharanu v'yochal gamachol es kaspeinu. So he doesn't think we're family. He thinks we're strangers. He sold us. He's taken away all our money. Ki chala osher asher hitzil lohim me'avinu lanu v'lubaneinu v'yatakul asher amar lohim me'leich v'erecha atzei. That here he's just deceived us and taken all our stuff. And so whatever we have is ours, so we should go. So, really, Rachel is not only disrespecting Leah, she's speaking badly about her father. So that's a bigger avera. The Torah says, Arur makla bivimol, that somebody who speaks lightly about his parents, that's subject to a curse, that's subject to Arur. So that can be justified because loved one was a Russia. So fine, so then maybe it's legitimate to talk about him that way. But then we see that she's actually a little bit susceptible to that kind of meaning without justification, because she's treating Leah this way, even that little shtickle of hanhaga, that's enough to then take away some of the justification for the way she speaks about her father, and that's the cause of the onesh. It's a pretty scary idea. The Shvos Yaakov quotes this idea because the big machlokas the idea that one is obligated to respect an older brother. That's the Gemara in the end of Masechet Ketubos, towards the end of Masechet Ketubos in Daf Kuf Gimel. The Gemara says that there's a chiyuv to respect your older brother, and it's a big machlokus rishonim what that's about. So the Rambam, it sounds like that's about the status of the Bechor, who has a third parent kind of status, while the Ramban understands that it's a prat in Kibbut Avim, that we think that parents would probably want that there should be a hierarchical system, that younger siblings should respect the older siblings. So this is a big discussion in Leibus Varim, because it has an afkamina that the Rambam's meaning would seem to say that only the oldest son is entitled to a particular kavod. Not every sibling, not the in-between siblings, just the oldest son who's the Bechor. While the Ramban, his idea of a hierarchy, so that should seem to extend to all older siblings, not just the oldest, and not just the oldest son. So that's an afkamina between the two. So I always tell my family, so my son is the second, he has an older sister, and he has several younger sisters. So I tell him it's a good deal if he respects his older sister, because that shows that he holds that the din of kavod is to all older siblings, and he'll profit more because all the younger sisters, than him, will have to mechabit him. If he doesn't respect the older sister, he's holding it's only the din of the oldest sons, and then he's not going to get kavod from his younger siblings. So the Shvas Yaakov has a tshuva where he argues, and this is, I think, how most poskim assume, that it is by all older siblings; it's not just the oldest son. And he wants to bring a raya from here. This is something that we see. That apparently Rachel was chayiv and kavod to Leah. This is also a subject discussion elsewhere in the parasha. I can mean to it. It's a very long topic and almost out of time. But the hesitancy that we attribute to Laban and apparently some level of correctness in this idea that it was wrong to marry off the younger sibling before the older sibling, that he shouldn't marry off Rachel before Leah, so he therefore had to Laman Shem Shemayim marry off Leah first. So we do find that idea discussed in the poskim, and some consider whether it's based on kavod. If it's based on kavod, so then who does the kavod go to? Does it go only to an older son, or does it go to all older siblings? That's a whole part of the discussion. So it's relevant to this parsha in a couple of ways. It's relevant to all these parshas because the big discussion about Yaakov and Esav and other such issues, maybe a different time, we'll be able to get into that in a little bit more detail. But just to finish off, we're just about out of time. But we mentioned before, a parallel to the statement, why does Yaakov feel that he has to convince his wives? Why doesn't he just say that it's a mitzvah? So you find the same thing on the other end here, that this is a comment that Moshe Feinstein has, and it's interesting because I remember seeing, and maybe I saw this in the biography of Moshe Feinstein, I remember seeing many years ago, quoted specifically in the name of Moshe Feinstein, that he said that the common expression people say of Shveretz is I'm a Yid, it's difficult to be a Jew. He said it was bad that people say that. It's wrong that people do that because your kids hear that and they think that it's really difficult. They think that it's bad to be a Jew. This is a big nisayon nowadays. Very often, you know, parents complain about tuition, about things like that, and the kids are all sitting there listening and they get the message that, oh, it's miserable to be a yeshiva parent, it's miserable to be a religious Jew because it's got so many pressures. And Rav Moshe was always very concerned about what kind of impact that has on the kids who hear this. They don't get inspired by that. They just get deterred by that. So we've seen that quote in other contexts, that Rav Moshe was opposed to that expression. So I see this in Shritaso. I see this with Parsha and the Darash Moshe and the Kedushim of Rav Moshe Feinstein on the Chumash. He says exactly that on this pasuk. So it's the same question, the parallel of the question mentioned a few minutes ago. That why did Yaakov have to explain? Why did he just say, we got to go, God said so? So too, you can say about the wives in this pasuk, when they say, yeah, things have been horrible here, and Abba's taking all the stuff from us, so why don't they just say, well, Yaakov, it's a direction from God, you just told us that it was Nevuah, so we're going to go, whatever the circumstances are. So he suggests that this is a model for all of our relationship to the Word of God, that we shouldn't take the attitude and we shouldn't convey to our children that, well, you know, it would be great if we could just stay here, but God told us to, so we have to follow His word and uproot ourselves and be miserable, but that's what we do because we're religious Jews. So that's never a good message to transmit to your children, because your children will be deterred. They're not going to say, okay, I'll be as heroic as my parents and I'll do it even though it's there. They'll just say, forget it, it's too there. So too, this was what they were modeling, what Rachel and they were modeling. You're right, we should try to convey the message to our children that whatever Kadosh Baruch Hu was asking for us is not so hard to do. There's many reasons why it's manageable and why it's good for us and why we can perceive in this world all the benefits. And that's part of it. So that's, again, very relevant to our contemporary crisis in so many different ways. It's relevant to the terrible situation we find ourselves in globally and in Eretz Israel and the economic situation on a very different level. But all of it sometimes prompts us to convey to the next generation, oh, you see how hard it is to be a Jew, you see we're persecuted, you see we're harassed, you see that it's economically so challenging. And that's not the message you want to convey. You want to convey that it's beautiful to be a Jew, it's got its challenges, but the payoff is so much greater, and we're so privileged and happy to be able to do that. And if we can transmit that message, we have a much greater chance that the next generation will see it the same way. Okay, so we will end here. God willing, on Sunday we'll be able to talk about Chanukah, and we'll stop it now and then head to the base measures to join in the ceremony.